Okay, this particular shir closes the series of three shirim on the Rav's experience of Hanukkah, and we'll deal with a topic that's a general issue in Rambam studies, but also specifically for Hanukkah and how the Rav approached it. The title Hanukkah Mitzvah Midivrei Sofrim. The term Divrei Sofrim is a term that's used in the Mishnah. Not that I'm outstanding, brilliant person remembering every Mishnah baal peh by heart, but we have the advantage of the Bar Ilan project, and it was just a question of just pushing the right buttons to get the requisite information. Divrei Sofrim is mentioned 14 times in the entire Mishnah, of which several times they're mentioned twice in the same Mishnah. So there are really eight Mishnayot that support the phrase Divrei Sofrim, and in all of those, it means Derabanan. It means a rabbinic institution, sometimes a rabbinic restriction. And that phrase, Divrei Sofrim, is borrowed by the Rambam, the phrase itself, whereas the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah will sometimes alternate between Divrei Sofrim and Midivrehem, from their words. There are some of the late greats of the Achronim who wanted to nitpick here and say that when the Rambam says Divrei Sofrim, he meant one kind of rabbinic institution, and when he says Divrehem, he meant something else. I'm sorry to disappoint those great Talmidei Chachamim, but it happens to be not the case, because the Rambam sometimes speaks about the identical halakha in various places in the Mishneh Torah, and sometimes calls them Divrei Sofrim, and sometimes calls them Midivrehem. And therefore, they are basically synonymous terms, and they mean the same thing. What's not clear is what exactly did the Rambam mean when he said Divrei Sofrim? Because the world of rabbinic add-ons come in different packages. Rambam divides the entire oral law into five component parts, of which the first part he calls Dvar Torah, which means it's something that's clearly in the Torah, except what's in the Torah is a pasuk, a verse. Except you don't know exactly how to implement or carry out that particular verse, the mitzvah, or perhaps it might be defined as a transgression, an avirah. The Torah tells us in so many different places, let's say, putting on tefillin, u'kshartam la'ot ha'yadecha, v'ayu l'tot tefot b'neinecha. We don't have the foggiest idea what the ot, what the sign is on your hand, and what exactly is totefet on the head, and what does it mean between the eyes. These are a very, very cloudy understandings, and we necessarily have to have the oral law to bring us around and explain what the practical implementation of a pair of tefillin is all about based on a verse. But the fact that it's based on a verse means that that particular mitzvah is the oraita, is biblical from the Torah itself. But then there's another section of laws that are called halacha le-Moshe b'Sinai. We do not even begin with a pasuk. It's just floating in the air, and there's a halacha, there's a din, there's a law that we have to fulfill. And Rambam tells us that these laws are also called divrei sofrim, even though we usually treat them on the level of a type of biblical. But the Rambam believes that it's not exactly biblical, even though it emanates from the tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu from Sinai. So there are many, many such halachot under the category halacha le-Moshe b'Sinai. If you want to see the entire list, you can open up the Encyclopedia Talmudit. It's either in volume 10, 9, or 10, where the entire world of halacha is spelled out, and there's an article there called Halacha le-Moshe b'Sinai. You get it all. You get it all there, and there occasionally here and there might be some disputes, but that's the second category. The third category are those biblical mitzvot or concepts in halacha that emanate from the rules that are used to squeeze out the halacha from the pasuk itself. We call them midot ha-Torah nedreshet. And here too, there are different schools of thought. There's Rabbi Akiva, there's Rabbi Ishmael. That's a shir in itself. I don't want to get bogged down. But all these three, whether it's Dvar Torah, where it begins with the pasuk, or Halacha le-Moshe b'Sinai, it doesn't begin with a pasuk. And then you have the third, which there's a pasuk, except we don't know exactly how to implement it, but we don't have a tradition from Sinai on it. But the Sanhedrin, the Beit Din of every generation, could work it out and take a vote, and that would obligate Am Yisrael for that particular generation. That would be the third category of the oral law. The fourth and fifth are the easier ones to understand. They are clearly rabbinic. One is the positive rabbinic mitzvot, and one is the negative rabbinic mitzvot. So positive would be lighting candles on Hanukkah, reading the Megillah on Purim, and many, many others. The negative would be things like muktzah on Shabbat and many, many rabbinic prohibitions that we have in the world of kashrut and milk and so on. Many, many, many restrictions that emanate from our chachamim, and they are the gzerot. The positive are called the takanot. So we have takanot and gzerot. They're clearly midivrei sofrim. The problem is that the Rambam occasionally will employ the phrase divrei sofrim also for category 2 and 3, the halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai, and those laws that are derived from the midot shatorah nedreshet, from those rules. And that caused himself no small amount of agony. There are many, many responsa that have been sent to the Rambam and to his son, Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, for the Rambam to clarify what exactly he meant by Divrei Sofrim. But all I'm saying is that Divrei Sofrim is a phrase that comes from the Mishnah, and that's important because the Rambam borrowed phrases from the Mishnah. The Rambam himself, we know, in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, parallels the historical background of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. It's the post Bar Kokhba revolution. Am Yisrael was in turmoil. There was a momentary lull where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was able to produce the Mishnah and give it out to disseminate it to Am Yisrael. And ultimately, he saves the oral law by doing this. Rambam, 1,000 years later, draws a parallel historic picture with the need for his Mishneh Torah. And not only does he call it by the same name, Mishneh Torah, the same name as the Mishnah, but he also sets out to expand on Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's Mishnah, which basically was an initial pioneering attempt to codify all of the oral law, except that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi never does a complete job. Rambam sets out to do a complete job. So basically to complete the work of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi by adding 1,000 years of learning. The entire world of the Gemara, the Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, the entire world of the Geonim, all that is packed into the Mishneh Torah, codified, and it becomes the Mishneh Torah. But the Rambam also decides to write the Mishneh Torah in the language of the Mishnah. And that's a story in itself. We're not going to do the whole thing now, just make mention of the fact that practically all of the Rambam's halachic writings are written in Judeo-Arabic. And Judeo-Arabic, for all practical purposes, was the Rambam's Yiddish. So when we talk about Yiddish, so you may think about Yiddish that you perhaps know, or your parents or your grandparents spoke Yiddish back in the old home in the Altaheim. The Yiddish, as we know, is based on the German, but it's with the Aleph Bet and has some Jewish flavoring to it. Some Hebrew words are thrown into it. And we say it has Yiddish tam, it has Jewish flavor. Obviously, when you hear somebody speak Yiddish as opposed to somebody speaking pure German, it doesn't sound exactly the same, but they are very much related languages because Yiddish is almost a dialect of German, but it's written with the alphabet and written incorporating many, many Hebrew phrases that are known and well known to the people. But this phenomenon of Yiddish doesn't start with Yiddish in the 15th century. We already have Rashi with his La'az in his French. Basically, that was his French Yiddish. And we have the Ladino of the Spanish Jewish community. That was their Yiddish of sorts. We have the Aramaic of the days of the Talmud. It basically goes back to the second Beit HaMikdash, where the Babylonian Aramaic and there was the Eretz Yisrael Aramaic. This, for practical purposes, was their Yiddish. Because there was a secular language, if you may, of Aramaic, a Semitic language, but the Jewish people adopted that language and Judaized it, and just Pashut gave Aleph Bet to it, and with some Hebrew trimmings, which means it became a type of Yiddish. The Yiddish that I'm talking about now is the basis is Arabic. It's not the spoken Arabic on the street, but it's literary Arabic, and that became known as Judeo-Arabic with the Aleph Bet letters, with also some Hebrew molded into this language. This language, Rav Sadia Gaon wrote in Judeo-Arabic, Rabbi Yehuda Levi writes in Judeo-Arabic, And the Rambam wrote most of his halakhic books in Judeo-Arabic. The Mishnah commentary, the book on the mitzvot, the Mora Nebuchim, his philosophical work, all of his medical writings are all in Judeo-Arabic. So the big chidush, the novelty, is that Mishnah Torah, he writes in Hebrew. And he writes in Hebrew for a specific reason, that he wants it to become popular and should make it across the globe. And by him, the globe meant not only North Africa and Yemen, but it also meant Europe. And for it to make it into Europe, he would not be able to write it in Judeo-Arabic. He writes it in Mishnah Hebrew, the Hebrew of the Mishnayot. And he feels that the average Jew on the street has been acquainted with Mishnah. He does not feel that the average Jew in the street is acquainted with the language of Gemara, and therefore he rejects that. He does not use biblical Hebrew, for he feels it's not rich enough to say what he has to say. But he decides finally that it will become the language of the Mishnah. So you have the language is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. The purpose of the Mishnah. Mishnah Torah reflects that which was the purpose of Mishnah, the name of the book, Mishnah Torah. But today we're going to see something even more novel, why the Rambam puts under one heading the laws of Megillah and Chanukah. So this will begin with source number one. I'm going to put it up on the page. Give me just 1 second. Screen, yes. Okay, here we go. Okay. The first source comes from the laws of Megillah and Chanukah. The introduction, Rambam, Hilchot, Megillah, v'Chanukah. Here's the introduction. And before Rambam begins any section of Halakha, he gives us an intro, somewhat of an index even, to what he's going to talk about, a type of table of contents. And he writes, Hilchot, Megillah, v'Chanukah, the laws of Megillah and Chanukah. Yesh b'chlalan shtei mitzvot asei, there are two positive mitzvot, midivrei sofrim, from rabbinic origin, ve'einan min haminyan, and they don't count to the counting of the 613 commandments. Now, we may think that those three words, ve'einan min haminyan, are superfluous, because if he's already telling us that the mitzvah of Chanukah and the mitzvah of Purim are rabbinic in origin, then we pretty much know that they're not part of the 613 mitzvot. We would not have expected Moshe Rabbeinu to come down from Sinai and instruct us to read the Megillah on the 14th or 15th of Adar. And he wouldn't even come down and say, by the way, hold off with this mitzvah, but wait until a Haman comes along and tries to destroy Am Yisrael. And when Am Yisrael survives that, then this mitzvah kicks in. There is no such halakhic animal. That couldn't happen. And so too with regard to Chanukah, Moshe Rabbeinu would not come down from Sinai and say, just be patient until the miracle of the Chashmonaim and the Beit HaMikdash, and from then on we're going to light Hanukkah candles. This is a halachic impossibility, and therefore Be'inan min haminyan seems to be superfluous. But it's not superfluous, because what the Rambam is doing here is he's negating some other views. And it's interesting that both Rabbi Sadia Gaon and before Rav Sadia Gaon is read in the 9th, 10th century. And before then, you have the author of the Halachot Gedolot, known popularly as Behag, Bet Hei Gimel, Baal Halachot Gedolot. The author of the Halachot Gedolot, a absolute positive authorship we don't know, so we just call him anonymously the Behag, the Baal Halachot Gedolot. And it was a pioneering attempt to organize the mitzvot of the Torah into lists, which, interestingly enough, before the 7th century, such a list never existed. When you study the Mishnah, forget about Tanakh, when you study the Mishnah and the Gemara, you do not come across a list of the 613 mitzvot. And the first attempt to organize material into a list was done by the Halachot Gedolot, and then Rabbi Sadia Gaon puts out a book of mitzvot on his own. He also writes a poem that incorporates all of the 613 mitzvot as he understood it. Some Sephardi communities read that poem on Chag HaShavuot. And then the Rambam comes along in the 12th century and he negates many of the mitzvot that are listed by Rav Sadia Gaon and the author of the Halachot Gedolot on the grounds that those are not biblical mitzvot. They are rabbinic mitzvot. And if it's a rabbinic commandment, its place is not in the listing of the 613. And Chanukah and Purim are both listed by the Rav Sadia Gaon and the author of the Halachot Gedolot as positive mitzvot. They're there as part of the 613. And the Rambam takes aim at them, and he says, absolutely not, this is an error. And that's why when he begins the section of Megillah and Chanukah, he says, these are rabbinic mitzvot, mitzvot aseh mi devrei sofrim. And just to, you know, hammer in home the point, the einan min haminyan, they are not part of the counting. And this is clearly done to negate those who felt that these two mitzvot have a place in the listing of the 613. I scanned the entire Mishneh Torah to see if the Rambam ever used this phrase on any other occasion in the intro to a section of Halakha. And it turns out there's one other example, and it's the laws of Erevin. The laws of Erevin are all rabbinic. And the Rambam says there too, in the Hilchot Erevin, that it's ve'eino min haminyan, that it's not part of the, says that he talks about the laws of Erevin. He says there's one mitzvah, and it's rabbinic, ve'eino eina min haminyan. It's not part of the 613. And the only question is, why there did the Rambam have to tell us that it's eina min haminyan? And I believe the answer happens to be, can be located in the fact that there's a dispute between Rambam and Ramban whether Tchum Shabbat, walking outside the parameters of the perimeters of the city, a certain distance, and the question of what the distance is also subject to a dispute, whether that's rabbinic or biblical. Rambam believes it's biblical, and Ramban believes it's rabbinic in origin. But everybody believes that the idea of the Eruv Tehumin, to allow you to double the walking from 2,000 Amot to 4,000 Amot, that's clearly rabbinic. And other applications of Eruv are clearly rabbinic. And I think the Rambam may have been interested that people shouldn't fall into the trap and say, if the Rambam believes that Tchum Shabbat is biblical, perhaps Erevin is also biblical on some level. And he wants to negate that immediately. And he says, Einan min haminyan there. But that's not our discussion here. Our discussion is with regard to Chanukah and Purim. So the question is, why didn't the Rambam simply speak about the laws of Megillah, two chapters? He has two chapters there. And then talk about the laws of Chanukah. And he also has two chapters there. We know that the Rambam has a section called Chametz Umatzah. He has eight chapters on Pesach. And then he has the laws about the Sukkah and Lulav and Esrog, Arba Minim, Hilchot Lulav. The Rambam dedicates sections of the book of Zmanim, which is the third of the 14 books of the Mishnah Torah, to the Shabbat and Chagim and the Yamim Tovim. So Rambam could have easily dedicated a section to Megillah and another section to Chanukah. Now, if we look at the Mishnayot, we know there is a Masechet called Megillah. There happens not to be a Masechet called Chanukah, and that's a shear in itself. There are some suggestions that the Chanukah was boycotted by Rav Yehuda HaNasi. I personally don't believe that's true. I have other reasons why Chanukah is not, there's no Masechet. But to say boycott, you can count eight references of Chanukah in the Mishnah itself, and that's not called a boycott. There really wasn't a lot of material, and it wiggles into the Gemara in the second chapter of Masechet Shabbat, Bamem Adlikin. So it's in the Gemara, it's not in the Mishnah. But the Rambam decides, under one roof, to call this Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah. And the question is, why does he do this? And we're going to plow out two different reasons. One is something that our Rebbe discussed, and it'll be the core of the shir of Soloveitchik. And one is a more methodological reason that I'm suggesting here that I believe is absolutely true because I've seen it throughout the Mishnah Torah. And that is, and this is why I gave you the whole intro to the connection between the Mishnayot of Rav Yehuda HaNasi and Mishnah Torah of the Rambam. We know that in the Mishnah, we go through Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, all of the six orders of Mishnah that are broken down into Mesichtot. There happen to be today 63 Mesichtot in the Shas, the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, even though in the days of Chachamim, they talked about 60. And there's even a reference to Shishim Gibrei Shlomo, a number mentioned in Shir HaShirim. But we also know that some of the Mesichtot somehow expanded, and once upon a time, they used to be one Mesechet, like Baba Kama, Baba Messiah, Baba Batra. Today, I list as three Mesichtot. Once upon a time, it was one Mesechet called Mesechet Nezikin. But it was a very heavy Mesechet, and it had 30 chapters. Take note, 30 chapters. But what they did was they split it into three evenly, 10, 10, and 10, and called the first one the first gate, or in Aramaic, Baba Kama. The second one was called the middle gate, or in Aramaic, Baba Metzia. And the third one was called the last gate, and that was called Baba Batra. So each one has 10 chapters, and the Masechet Nezikin actually had 30 chapters. There's also another, so here you have a net saving of two by taking three and making it into one. And then the Masechet Sanhedrin and the Masechet Makot also expanded into two Masechtot. Once upon a time it was one. So you have another one extra. So that's where the 60 became 63. But in theory, there's 60 Masechtot of Shas. When you study how many chapters you have in any particular Masechet, so it could be a variety of numbers, but you will take note that there is not one Masechet in the entire Shas that's less than three chapters. There's no such thing as Perek Aleph and Perek Bet, and let's move on to the next Masechet. It doesn't exist. It must necessarily have three chapters. Why? You're going to have to ask Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi why. And it does not have more than 30 chapters. We have two examples of it. One I just gave you now. What was once upon a time Masechet Nezikin? It was the 10, 10, 10 of Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra. That was 30 chapters. The other example is instead of Taharot, Masechet Kelim goes up to Perek Lamed. But there is no such thing as Perek Lamed Aleph 31. It doesn't exist. So the limits of the size of a Masechet in Mishnah going using the number of chapters in a particular Masechet is from 3 to 30. That's the span. Exactly why Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi does it, is it arbitrary? Did he think about it? Was it pre-planned? I don't have a clue. There's no indication anywhere that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had some particular reason for it. But the fact is, it's from 3 to 30. What's equally factual is that in the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam, the identical literary policy is present. And that is, there is no corpus of halacha in the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam less than three chapters, and there's no corpus greater than 30 chapters. The only example of 30 chapters happens to be Hilchot Shabbat. It goes up to Perek Lamed. And with regard to three chapters, there are several examples of it. Hilchot Chagiga has three chapters and a few others that come to mind. So three, you have several examples of it, just as you have several examples of three in the Mishnah too, but not necessarily corresponding to the same areas of halakha as the Rambam. But nevertheless, the number 3 to 30 is identical in Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's Mishnah and the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. And having said that, the fact that Megillah, Hilchot Megillah, the laws of Megillah only have two chapters of material, and the laws of Hanukkah only have two chapters of material, they could not stand independently according to this literary policy. And therefore, the Rambam had no other choice but to link them to something else. And the obvious was link them together. And it becomes Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah. I'm going to give you an example. The mitzvah of Birkat Kohanim, Nisiat Kapayim, what we call in Yiddish English, Duchening, which I remember back in the old home in the States, it was just for the Chagim in Ashkenazi circles. That's the minhag, that the Kohanim go up for Birkat Kohanim only for the Chagim, the Yamim Tovim, and only by Musaf. Here in Eretz Yisrael, there's Birkat Kohanim every single morning, and on Shabbat twice, and in Yom Kippur even three times. By Nila, there's a Birkat Kohanim. There's plenty of Birkat Kohanim here in Eretz Yisrael. So the Rambam has exactly two chapters of material on the mitzvah of Birkat Kohanim. So as I said, two chapters cannot stand independently. So what the Rambam does, he attaches it as a type of maftir to the laws of Tefillah. So the laws of Tefillah could have gone till the 13th chapter, and chapter 14 and 15, now the headline changes to Hilchot Nisiat Kapayim, the laws of Birkat Kohanim. And that is done because the Rambam designed his work with this built-in policy of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi that he would not have a corpus of halakha of only two chapters stand independently. It would necessarily have to be linked to something else. And this is why Megillah and Hanukkah are together. Now the question is, why put them together? There's no better reason than they're both mitzvot aseh midivrei sofrim. They both talk about historic episodes in Am Yisrael where we were in big trouble. There are differences between Purim and Hanukkah, no doubt, but nevertheless, there are many, many common themes to it. And in each one, Chachamim designed a Yom Tov and designed a mitzvah associated with that Yom Tov. And there are so many common themes that the Rambam felt that we could put them together. So that's, we say Ad Kan, that's the idea of the literary connection. But now let's see what the Rav had to say about all this. So we look at source number two. So source number two is actually, I'm not going to read it inside, is exactly what the Rambam said about his reasons for writing the Mishneh Torah in the language of the Mishnah. And I elaborated about this several minutes ago. This is his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, where he writes, we just completed the Perush HaMishnah, and now we're going to write a new book called Mishneh Torah, but before I get to it, I'm going to write the book of Mitzvot. And he says, and he tells us what the purpose of the Mishneh Torah was and why it's going to be written in the language of the Mishnah. I'm now on source number three. Source number three is Hulchot Megillah B'Chanukah, Perek Gimel Halacha Aleph. But even though it's the third chapter, it's actually the very first halacha. As we said, Aleph and Bet is Megillah, and Gimel and Dalet is Chanukah. So here we are on Perek Gimel, and the Rambam begins, B'Bayit Sheni, Kishemochei Yavan Gazru Gzerot Al Yisrael, in the second Beit HaMikdash era, when the Greeks laid these restrictions on Am Yisrael. And I'm just going to translate freely now. The religion was under attack, and they did not allow us to study Torah and perform mitzvot. We were robbed. Our daughters were taken. They entered into the Beit HaMikdash. They defiled everything that was pure there. And it was the difficulty for Am Yisrael was enormous. We were under sustained pressure, lachatz gadol, until God, the compassionate, was compassionate over us and allowed us to be victorious. Ve'etzilam, he delivered us from this tyranny. Ve'gavru b'nei chashmonai ha'kohanim ha'gdolim v'haragum, and the chashmonaim family, who were great kohanim. This doesn't mean each one served as a kohen gadol. They were kohanim who were great people, and they were victorious. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu had them deliver Am Yisrael Behemedo Melech Min HaKohanim, and a king was appointed from the Kohanim, V'chazra Malchut LeYisrael Yeta HaMatayim Shana Ad HaKurban HaSheni. And the monarchy to Israel was restored over 200 years until the second destruction of Second Beit HaMikdash. So just a few interesting points here, where the Rambam says that a king from the Kohanim was appointed. This was a very important point of contention that Ramban in Parshat Vayechi has it out for the Shevet Levi, who were not supposed to be the kings, but Shevet Yehuda was going to be the king. Lo yosu Shevet Yehuda u'mechokek mibein raglav. And the Ramban feels that indeed the wars were important, the victory significant, and the restoration of the monarchy very important. But after everything stabilized, the Maccabean dynasty was supposed to not become a dynasty. They were supposed to invite descendants of the Davidic line, Malchut Beit David, and assume the throne. In modern day politics, you don't usually see a president or a prime minister just getting up and saying, you are more worthy than I, and therefore, why don't you take over? That usually doesn't happen. And here, the Ramban felt that that's what the Hashmonaim should have done, but didn't do, and hence the Maccabean dynasty actually deteriorates. Now, the Rambam knew about the deterioration of the Malchut Beit Chashmonai, the Maccabean dynasty, yet he still has an all-around positive impression about what occurred, that the monarchy was restored to Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, for more than 200 years until the second destruction. That means in itself, even with bad kings, you still have value in having a Jewish kingdom, a Jewish government in Eretz Israel, and that's much better than having Greek or Roman authority or United Nations authority running the country. That's a clear statement by the Rambam. Now, one of the kings was Yanai HaMelech, and Yanai HaMelech drove out the Sanhedrin to Mitzrayim, even his own brother-in-law, Shimon ben Shetach, and Yehuda ben Tabai. We know these names from Pirkei Avot. And only when Yanai dies and then Shlom Tzion HaMalka takes over and brings them back to rehabilitate the Sanhedrin. So Yanai was really bad news in terms of being a king. And yet here in Yerushalayim, we have a street in his honor, Rehov Yanai. But if you know where Rehov Yanai is, it's a very small street and very crooked. So it's actually a perfect street that the municipality named Rehov Yanai. But you have a very important statement that the Rambam says, and this is all history. And now the next line, the Rambam gets into what we all know from kindergarten, the story of the miracle, Ukishagavu Yisrael Aloivehem, when Am Yisrael was victorious, Vavadum, and when did it happen? It was the 25th of the month of Kislev. We entered into the Beit HaMikdash. We only found one jar of oil that had still had the emblem or signature seal of the Kohen Gadol, and it had enough to light for one day's worth of lighting. But Hidliku Mimeno Neirot Marachah Shmona Yamim Ad Shekadshu Zeitim V'Otzeo Shem Taharos. So last week I already made mention of this line that in the name of the Rav, that this line showed that you cannot rely on a miracle if human action can actually do something to save yourself. You can rely on a miracle if you're desperate and you can do nothing. So you turn to Kadosh Baruch Hu and you yell for help. But if you have to daven to Kadosh Baruch Hu, even if you're able to take care of yourself, that it should go well. But you cannot sit on the sidelines and just say, all right, you know, God's going to be helpful to us and we don't have to do anything. That's not the case. And I say this specifically with regard to the vaccines. Nobody should say, Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of us. God should take care of us, indeed, but people should be vaccinated. And that's the thought that the Rambam says here, that the only reason that the duration of the miracle was 8 days, because for 8 days there was no other recourse, but on the ninth day they could have had their own oil, and therefore on the ninth day there was no longer a miracle. And the Rambam says, because of all of this, the war, the victories, the miracle, yitkinu chachamim shaboto ador, the chachamim of that generation instituted sheesh munat hayamim ha'elu, these 8 days that begin on the night, the eve of the 25th of Kislev, yemei simcha v'halel, days of joy and saying halel, madlikim behen haneirot be'erev al pitchei avatim, we will light candles on the door, by the door of our homes, v'chol layla v'layla, each and every night, mishmonat halelot, of the 8 nights, successive nights, laharotu lagalot anesa, we should publicize the miracle to all. And here comes the important point. V'yamim elu, and these days are called Chanukah, Nikraim Chanukah. And they are Asurim Bespe Betanit, forbidden to eulogize and to fast, Kimea Purim, just like Purim. Now the Rambam here knows that you're sitting in chapter 3. And the Rambam actually believed that when you read his Sefer, Mishneh Torah, you start it from the beginning and you work your way to the end. You don't open up the book in the middle. And he assumed that if you're reading chapter 3 of the laws of Megillah and Chanukah, you did read the laws of Megillah, the first two chapters. And indeed, in the first two chapters, where the Rambam talks about the laws of Purim, he will tell us that the days of Purim are forbidden for Hesped and Ta'anit. You cannot eulogize and you cannot have a fast day. And here the Rambam is saying, and the days of Chanukah, these 8 days, are forbidden for Hesped and Ta'anit, eulogizing and fasting, Kimei Purim, just like Purim. Okay, so he made his point. So I understand, you know, just as a type of refresher, Kimei Purim. But then the Rambam continues. But lighting candles is a rabbinic mitzvah, divrei sofrim, kikriyat ha-megillah. It's on the same pedestal as reading the Megillah on Purim. Now that's very strange. Why would the Rambam have to repeat the connection to Purim? He could have gotten away by saying, Hadlakat Nerot is a mitzvah midivrei sofrim. The lighting of the candles is a rabbinic commandment. Why does he have to say Kriyat HaMegillah? Why did he actually say Kimea Purim, like Purim, with regard to the prohibition of fasting and eulogies? And then in the next halacha, source number 6, the Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah, Perek Gimel, halacha Dalet, Kol Shechayav b'Kriyat HaMegillah, Chayav v'Hadlakat Ner Chanukah. Whoever is obligated in Megillah is also obligated in Chanukah. Wow, that seems to be totally superfluous. This is now the third mentioning in 2.5 lines of a connection between Chanukah and Purim. He mentioned that the Kimea Purim, he says Ki Kriyat HaMegillah, and now he's saying whoever's obligated in reading a Megillah, he's also obligated in lighting Chanukah candles. Who would have thought otherwise? Who would have thought that if there's a rabbinic mitzvah to light candles on Chanukah, you wouldn't do it unless you first heard about the fact that there was an obligation to read the Megillah on Purim. So we're going to see in a moment why, in the name of the Rav, why the Rambam specifically refuted 3 times a connection to connection of Hanukkah to Purim, and then we'll understand, according to the Rav, why the headline is Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah with the conjunction and v'Chanukah, why it all goes together almost in one breath. Before we get to that, one little side point on what I just read now. Kol shechayav b'kriyat ha-megillah, chayav b'hadlakat nerot Chanukah. In 1979-80, when our family came in Aliyah, so we went directly to Alon Shvut, and I was working at the yeshiva in an interesting capacity. But I had opportunities also to hear our great Rebbe Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, for a variety of shiurim. And he gave a shiur before Hanukkah at a time that his own father, who was aging and was losing his hearing, also lost his vision. Dr. Yechiel Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha. And I remember that we all learned a chapter in Kibbud Avaim from our Rebbe Rav Lichtenstein, who would take his father, very feeble old man, walk him to the Beit Midrash on Shabbat, and every single person who passed by, Rav Lichtenstein would introduce that person to his father, even though his father hardly heard anything and he didn't see who he was being introduced to. Rav Aaron felt that this was something that was important to give his father the courtesy, the kavod, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. That Hanukkah, Rav Lichtenstein was discussing, most probably with himself, the obligation of a blind person in Hanukkah candles. And the reason that became relevant, because his father had just turned blind. And the question is, and this is a halachic discussion, where if, obviously a blind person can be assisted to light the candle. But the question is, if the purpose of the candle is not only to be lit, but also to be viewed so that you are reminded of the story of the Beit HaMikdash, perhaps somebody who's blind does not have that facet of the mitzvah, and therefore that person may not be obligated at all in Ner Chanukah. So you may say that a blind person, and it is discussed in the poskim with regard to saying the brachot in the morning of Yotzer HaMa'orot, if he can't see the celestial bodies that illuminate the world, yet he is clearly helped by the fact that other people can see the difference between day and night, and hence he could say the bracha Yotzer HaMa'orot without any question. But with regard to Hanukkah candles, it became a question. The posek that really dealt with this very, very seriously was the Maharshal, Moren Rav Shlomo Luria. He was from Lublin in the 16th century. He's one of the personalities who, when the groups go to Poland, they go to the old cemetery of Lublin, and they stand by the kever of the Maharshal, Moren Rav Shlomo Luria. And the Maharshal has a very lengthy responsum, a tshuva, dealing with this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And his conclusion is that he cannot decide. So what is his eitzah? If he can't decide, he has to give an eitzah, he has to give a suggestion. So the suggestion is that the blind person should financially contribute to the candles of somebody in the household who is lighting, and he becomes a partner. And that's derived from what the Gemara talks about, achsanai, which means somebody who's a guest. Now, somebody is a guest at somebody else's home on Hanukkah, so the person should participate with even if it's a small amount of money. The Gemara talks about a pruta. Pruta, you know, just you give a shekel to somebody, and you're a partner now with his candles and his light and his oil, and you become partner in the candle lighting. And the Maharshal said that's what the blind person should do. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Zecharon Livracha, was not happy with that kind of compromise arrangement. Because what the Maharshal was doing is, he's saying, you know, I really can't decide, because he can go either way. And therefore, I have to tell the person asking me the question what to do, as they say, tachlis, what to do. So the tachlis was to participate in somebody else's lighting by giving him some money. And Rav Aaron did not want to give that answer to his father. And he worked it out. He worked it out that his father would actually be fully obligated. He gave various proofs in halacha to that effect. But one of them, and I remember this till this very day, he quoted his son, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. Today, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is one of the three Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Tzion Tzion. Then Moshe Lichtenstein in 1980 was barely out of high school. He was barely out of high school in 1980. And Rav Lichtenstein said that years before, Rav Moshe, as a student, as a teenager, suggested to his father that when the Rambam says Kol shechayav v'kriyat ha-Megillah, whoever is obligated in Megillah reading is obligated in Hanukkah candle. Well, what's the deal with a blind person for Megillah reading? Obviously, a blind person has to hear the Megillah. It's true, he's not going to be able to read the Megillah, but he's going to have to hear the Megillah, whether it's at shul, Beit Knesset, whether it's at home, wherever it is, he's obligated in listening to the Megillah. And the Rambam says, whoever's obligated in reading the Megillah is also obligated in the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. And there you go. The grandfather, as he was saying then, Rav Lichtenstein was speaking about his father, certainly was obligated in Megillah reading, so he's obviously obligated in candles of Hanukkah. Rav Lichtenstein brought many other proofs to this, but I remember how proud he was to quote his own son on this particular halakha, which obviously made an impression on me because I'm talking about it some 40 years later. Kol shechayav b'kriyat ha-Megillah, chayav b'hadlakat ner Chanukah. But what did the Rav have to say about this? The Rav said that the reason that Hanukkah is attached to Megillah is because if not for Purim, there never would have been a Hanukkah. It would be absolutely necessary to substantiate the halachic legitimacy of Megillah and Purim, and only afterwards could we expand a type of permissibility to add holidays, festivals, Yomim Tovim, to the Jewish calendar. And this came up already in the days of Mordechai and Esther. The Gemara says, Masechta Megillah, Dav Zayin, source number 7, Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda. Shmuel, son of Yehuda, says, Shalcha Lahem Esther Lachachamim. Esther sent a letter to the Chachamim of the generation. Kev'uni Lidarot. Let's establish this for the generations to come. And some say, Shalchu La Esther Lachachamim Kitvuni Lidarot. Let's write it down as the book of Tanakh, which means there were two questions here. One was, well, I would like to establish Purim as a national Yom Tov for posterity annually on the 14th and 15th of Adar. Furthermore, we'd like to have the story, which is going to be sitting in the library of Shushan, as it says in the last pasuk, Kaleim Tuvim, Masefa, Ki Mordechai HaMelech, Mishneh LeMelech HaChashverosh, Doresh Tov LaMo. It says that it was Haloim Tuvim B'Sefer Divrei Yamim L'Malchei Madayu Faras. It was in the annals, the historic archives of the Egyptians. And the Ebenezer says that's why God's name, Kadosh Baruch Hu's name, not mentioned in Megillah, because they realized where this book is going to be sitting and who its company is going to be in the library shelf with pagan works and so on, and it would be an embarrassment and insult to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, so we kept God's name conspicuously absent. That's one of the reasons that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name is not there. There are other reasons. But what Esther wanted was that it should become a part of Tanakh. And we know that it didn't happen overnight, because there's a Mishnah in the third chapter of Masechet Yadayim that we know that the litmus test, if something is sacred writing, Kitvei Kodesh, is if you touch it, do your hands become tummy? It's a very funny thing. Your hands becoming tummy by touching something that's essentially holy. And the problem was that they were storing the parchments of Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim in all kinds of aron boxes, where the mice would nibble on it. Why would the mice all of a sudden nibble on parchment? Because when people had truma food, when they took off truma from various fruits and vegetables before they had opportunity to give it to a kohen, so that no person in the family would, God forbid, eat the truma food, they felt the best place to put it is in the Aron Kodesh. So, of course, the mice didn't know that these fruits and vegetables were holy, and they would somehow break into the Aron Kodesh and eat the fruits, and when they were finished for dessert, they would nibble on the parchments. So parchments got ruined. And what Chachamim said was that the parchment of Kitvei Kodesh emanate Tumah. That's unbelievable. Tumah is a uncleanliness, a spiritual uncleanliness, because they wanted to guarantee that the last place in the house you're going to put the Truma foods is in the Aron Kodesh. So this became the litmus test if something is Kodesh or not. And with regard to Megillat Esther, there was a dispute whether it was Metameh et Hayadayim or not, which shows that it was not so clear that even up to the days of the Mishnah, that Megillat Esther was part and parcel of Tanakh. I can tell you that in Antiquities of the Jews of Flavius Josephus, he talks about the 22 books of the Canaan of the Bible. 22, not 24. And some claim that is a scribal mistake. Fine, it really was said 24. But some say, no, Josephus wrote 22, because in his day, it's possible that two books weren't yet in there, one being Meginat Esther and one being perhaps Kohelet. There was all discussion about Shira Shirim, but Rabbi Akiva puts his foot down. He says, all the books are Kodesh, Shira Shirim is Kodesh Kodeshim, but Kohelet wasn't so simple that it was part of Kitzir HaKodesh and Megillat Esther. So here you have a discussion in the Gemara that Esther is begging the Chachamim, put it down in writing and incorporate it into Tanakh, and also let's put it into the calendar, Kavuni L'Dorot, and it should be a Yom Tov. So there is a reference at the end of Megillat Esther to this discussion. L'kayem et yimei ha-purim ha'ela, the last source, number 8. L'kayem et yimei ha-purim ha'ela bizmanehem, that people should observe Purim in its proper time. Kasher kiyam aleihem Mordechai Yehudi v'Ester HaMalkah, as Mordechai and Esther did at that time, we should be doing it for years later. V'chasher kimu al nafsham v'al zar'am divrei ha-tzomot v'zakatam, as they also took upon themselves and their future generations, the fast days and the days of petition and prayer and zaka and screaming at God and so on. So some think that the Divrei Hatzomot v'Zakatam is a reference to the middle of the Megillat Esther, where Esther suggests to Mordechai, Lech kinos et kol ha'yudim v'tzum olai v'al tochlu v'al tashtu shloshet yamim laila v'yom, you should fast, not eat, and so on. And so it became a very, very unifying moment of tefillah and fasting. So just like you listened to us then, you should listen to us now. We want to have a new chag. But the Rav said something else happened here. And what he said, it can actually be found in the Eben Ezra as well. But the Rav developed this as follows. The argument that Mordechai and Esther used to the Chachamim was this Divrei Tzalmot Vazakatam. The Chachamim said, you know, it's a wonderful idea, we should have Purim. There's only one catch. The Torah says, Lo tosif, you're not allowed to add things. So we can't add it. I'm sorry. It's a wonderful thing. But the Torah forbades the addition of mitzvot. And you have in Parshat Vetchanan and Parshat Re'eh, twice the Torah says, Lo tosif alav. You're not allowed to add mitzvot. So the response of Mordechai and Esther was, all right, but you know, you were already guilty of that when you instituted the fourth fast in commemoration of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. We know the four fasts are already mentioned in the book of Zechariah, and obviously it refers to the first destruction, not the second. And there it says that the Tzom HaRevi'i and Tzom HaChamishi and Tzom HaShvi'i and Tzom HaAsiri, that one day these four fast days of Tammuz and Av and Tishrei, which was Tzom Gedalia, and Tevet, Asar B'Tevet, Yeh LeBeit Yudala Sosom HaSamcha. The question was, now that we're building the second Beit Midash, what's the deal with these fast days? Do we continue fasting, or as it says in the book of Zechariah, Ha'efkeh et Tzom HaChamishi, should we wail on the fast of the fifth day of Av? Should we continue fasting Tisha B'Av? That was really the Shaila. It's a Shaila. It's a question of Halacha that was asked in the Novi. And the response was that these four fast days are going to be Yemei Sason Simcha. The problem is the answer was beautiful, except you don't have a clue what the answer was. Was it yes or no? And there's a dispute amongst Parshanei biblical commentators. What did Zechariah say? Did he say, right, we don't have to fast it? Or did he say, no, we do have to fast it, but there'll be a day in the future that these days are going to become chagim, moadim. That's how the Rambam took to it. Rambam believes that throughout the Bayit Sheni, we continue to fast Tisha B'Av, at least Tisha B'Av. So the argument that Mordechai and Esther use against the Chachamim was, where were you when they instituted the fast days? That was also Baal Tosif. That was also addition to the calendar. There were fast days, not festivals, but nevertheless, it was Baal Tosif, it was additional. And they said, okay, one second. They really weren't, they didn't create something new, a new invention. The concept of a day of fasting and tefillah, we have in the Torah, it's called Yom Kippur. But what they did was, there's a mentioning in the Chumash itself that v'chitavo b'artzachem, v'atzar atzorer etchem, v'chitavo luchama b'artzachem, v'atzar atzorer etchem, v'aureyotem b'chatzotzcho. There might become days. The Torah is not going to tell you right now, predict what date and what event may happen. If, God forbid, you go through some tzara, you will react to it. So there's an opening in the Chumash for Chachamim to establish things to deal with difficult situations and crisis moments. And we only had Yom Kippur to look toward, because Yom Kippur was a fast day and it was a day of tefillah. So what we did was we borrowed the theme of Yom Kippur and applied it now to the 17th of Tammuz and 9th of Av and Tish and the Tzom Gedalia and 10th of Tevet and so on. That's all. There's no Baal Tosif there. So the Esther and Mordechai said, if that's the case, Let's start opening up the Chumash and see if there's a parallel type of pasuk where we can snuff out that you can add a Yom Tov. And indeed, they find the pasuk in Parshat Ve'etchanan. Ki mi goy gadol, who is that great nation, asher lo elokim, lo with a vav, that it's this nation has a God, karshem elokeinu b'chol koreinu elav, when this nation is in trouble, they turn to God and he listens to us. Well, Mordechai and Esther said, that's us, that's what we did. And now we want to remember that great event that a Kadosh Baruch Hu saved us as, and we were in a tzara, we were a great tzara. It was almost a Holocaust, there's no other word for it. Lashmid la'rogu la'beit et kol ha'yudim, total annihilation of Am Yisrael. And thank God we got out of it. And we want to recognize this annually and say Shevach Vodaya, not a one-shot deal, but every year to remember this. So it's like pulling out from this pasuk an allowance to also have a chag, just like you did it with Tisha B'Av, we would like to do it for a chag. And they agreed. So this pasuk basically says, Kasher kiyam alehem Mordechai Yehudi v'Ester HaMalkah, v'chasher kimu al nafsham v'al zaram divrei atzmot v'zakatam. Just like you accepted Tisha B'Av and the other fast days, you should accept now the idea of a chag. And this is why Purim was accepted into the calendar. Once the precedent had been established with regard to Purim, it was not didn't take long for another historic episode to have the Chachamim of the generation knock on the door and say, let's put this into the calendar as well. Because they didn't have to stop the argument again. The argument has been resolved in favor of inclusion of a new festival, new Chag, into the calendar. And that's why Hanukkah is actually an outgrowth of Purim. And hence the Rambam calls it Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah, the laws of Megillah and Chanukah, almost hyphenated. And that's why the Rambam, no fewer than three times, will equate the halachot of prohibition of fasting and eulogies like Kimei Purim, like Purim. He will equate the lighting of the Chanukah candles as a mitzvah midivrei sofrim as the reading of the Megillah. And he will say that those who are obligated in the reading of the Megillah, kol shechayav b'kriyat Megillah, chayav b'hadlakat ner Chanukah, are also obligated in the ner Chanukah. And hence we see that these two mitzvot actually are forged together on the one heading. And that's not an accident at all, but it's very, very deliberate by the Rambam, Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah. Notwithstanding everything I said at the beginning of the shir, which I believe is also correct, and you know what we have is what we call Elu v'Elu Devrei Elokim Chayim. This is true, that's true. There are two different ways of seeing something, and at least I think I presented here a type of multiple, you know, see a vision of how to see how the Rambam structured the laws of Megillah and Chanukah together. And God willing, we will. We are in the midst of Chanukah right now, and I'll just end by saying that the Rambam in the laws of Chanukah unloads all the halachot of Hallel. Now, I know we say Hallel on Chanukah, but we say Hallel 18 days during the year. Chutz La'aretz even 21. But that includes the first day of Pesach. It includes Shavuot, one day here in Israel. It includes the 7 days, 8 days of Sukkot, and then the 8 days of Chanukah. So you have the 8 days, 18 days. So eight is not even the majority of the 18. It's almost the majority. It's almost half of the 18. But the majority are actually not Chanukah. So the Rambam actually could have talked about the laws of Hallel. He could have integrated it into the laws of Tfilah easily enough. He could have integrated it into the laws of the other Yamim Tovim that are the Oraita, for example, Pesach or Sukkot, where he talks about the Arba Minim being special Simcha. It could have gone there as well. The Rambam obviously gave thought to where he's going to talk about Hallel, and he knew he didn't have enough material to write Hilchot Hallel. He barely has one chapter, he has a half a chapter. In the third chapter of the Laws of Chanukah, where he talks about all you wanted to know about Hallel, you're afraid to ask. So he has to put it somewhere. He opts to put it in, grafts it onto the Laws of Chanukah. And the reason is because the Rambam believes that as he talks about the obligation of Hallel on Chanukah, he says, "Below Chanukah zubulvad, not only on Chanukah, but anytime we have Hallel, which means including Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, it's also midrabanan, midivrei sofrim." And that's why the Rambam puts it in the laws of Chanukah, because there are some who count the mitzvot, who count Hallel on the Chagim as a biblical mitzvah. And the Rambam believe that Hallel is always midivrei sofrim, always, always, always. And hence, the precedent of the location of Hanukkah as a mitzvah midivrei sofrim, the obligation to say Hallel as a mitzvah midivrei sofrim is obviously appropriate to place it on the laws of Hanukkah, where the entire Hanukkah is midivrei sofrim, and that became for the Rambam a more natural location to deal with the laws of Hanukkah, not only for the laws of Hallel, not only for Hanukkah, but also the laws of Hallel for all the other Chagim. And the last thought from the Rav with regard to Hallel is that Hallel is not just pure Hallel of Hodu Lashem Kitov, but as you all know, it also includes Min HaMeitzar Karati La. We're in difficult trouble. Anashem Oshiana, Anashem Atzlichana. We ask Kadosh Baruch Hu to get us out. That's petition. That's Tachnunim. And indeed, what we do in Hallel today, said the Rav, is that we're involved in saying Hallel, but also recognizing that we're not out of the woods, and there's still room for Kadosh Baruch Hu to help us in so many different areas. But on Seder night, when we feel that there will be a vision of absolute Geulah, so we say, V'nomar lefanav shira chadasha, hallelujah. It's going to be a new style of Hallel. So the Rav said, it's not going to be a new text, it's not going to be a new niggun, but shira chadasha means it's going to be Hallel without the tachnunim, without the petition. And to that end, we certainly hope that the Kadosh Baruch Hu should give us that good fortune of witnessing that era, or perhaps as the Sfaradim say the bracha, Shasanisim Labotenu, God made miracles to our forefathers by Amim Ahem in those days, Ubaz Manazeh, and God willing, in our days as well. Erev Tov and Hanukkah Sameach from Yerushalayim. Everybody's muted.
Somebody wants Rabbi, to say something?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure. I'm with you.
Hello, it's Sandra Rappaport in New York. So could it be, it's a little bit of a drush, and I know Rabbi Lookstein often says in his shirim that when Rabbi Soloveitchik would depart from the halacha, he'd say, this isn't halacha, this is drush. So is it possible that this is a little drush? So when we say the Purim, it's Yom Kippurim. So is what you described about the connection, the argument that Esther and Mordechai apocryphally made for the Chachamim to connect, to somehow put it on as a caboose, as the carried along with the train of why we had to put the fast, since we put the extra four fast days, couldn't we also attach the same argument to allowing Purim? Could that be a drush of why it's called Kippurim?
Okay, so the word is Kippurim. Mm-hmm. It emanates from Kabbalistic sources. Mm-hmm. That Yom Kippur is Yom Ki as Purim. So it actually connects Yom Kippur.
It goes backwards, right. It's not that Purim is like Yom Kippur. It's like that Yom Kippur is like Purim.
Right, so even though it's a Kabbalistic source, the Rav had a nice take on that, and he said that Yom Kippur actually has a dual identity. On the one hand, it's a fast day with upgraded tefillah, but it's also a Yom Tov. And a Yom Tov requires that you have to eat and drink, but you can't do that on a fast day. So that's where Chachamim came up with the idea of eating on Erev Yom Kippur. So eating on Erev Yom Kippur as a mitzvah is not just to fill up the tank before the fast day. It's in fulfillment of Simchat Yom Tov of Yom Kippur. And he said that's where the connection to Purim is. Because Purim is, on the one hand, a Yom Mishteh B'Simcha, a day of enjoyment with drinking and feasting and so on. But we should not forget that it was a near miss. And the idea of Tanit Esther the day before is because you can't have Tanit Esther on Purim, because you have to drink, you have to eat and drink. So we do is we fulfill the Tzara part of it the day before. In Yom Kippur, it's just the opposite. We fulfill the Yom Tov part of it the day before. And the Rav, his point of departure was that Kabbalistic notion of Yom Kippurim. they like for him.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Kol tov to everybody.
Thank you so much.
Hanukkah Sameach to everybody.
Hanukkah Sameach. Be well.